The immediate, almost addictive satisfaction of seeing a quick, sometimes dramatic, price bump versus the often grueling, low visibility work of genuine product innovation beat. That tension, that constant push and pull, is what we're dissecting today.
That really is the central dilemma of many growing crypto protocols right now. It forces a choice: optimize the optics of the token today or invest in the utility of the protocol tomorrow.
Exactly. We're looking at crypto buybacks, a powerful financial lever that offers instant scarcity, but perhaps dangerously, often obscures the crucial long-term strategy required for survival. What are protocols really sacrificing when they prioritize that short-term spike? It's the opportunity cost we need to weigh.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is laser-focused. We are diving deep into the source material shared by one of our listeners concerning crypto token buybacks and the profound strategic choices teams face when allocating capital. We're moving past the simple transaction and into the deeper governance question.
Yeah, and we're addressing that core burning tension, supporting the token's price in the immediate term versus investing in the long-term sustainable growth of the ecosystem itself.
Right.
When capital is finite, every choice of where to deploy that revenue is a choice of what not to build.
So here's our roadmap for this exploration. First, we need to unpack the rigorous mechanics, why holders love buybacks, focusing on how they generate immediate demand and scarcity, almost like flipping an instant switch.
Second, we will explore the immense and often unseen cost, the opportunity cost. We'll be comparing these allocation decisions to choices made by traditional market giants like Apple to understand the difference between optimizing supply and expanding demand.
And finally, we'll analyze the criteria for maturity. When, if ever, do buybacks transition from being a quick fix or, a shortcut to becoming a strategically sound, disciplined move for a truly mature protocol that has exhausted other high-return options?
This deep dive is designed to give you the necessary context to truly understand the complex dynamics of capital allocation in the crypto world, moving far beyond the simple narrative of number go up.
Yeah.
We need to understand why the number went up and what they had to give up to achieve it.
Okay, let's dive in.
Okay, so let's unpack this foundational distinction because it's where a lot of people coming from traditional finance trip up when they start looking at crypto assets. The sources are very clear. Holding a crypto token is fundamentally not the same as holding equity, like stock share, in a traditional corporation.
No, not at all.
This is the cornerstone of the entire buyback dilemma.
That distinction is paramount. When you own a share of stock in a public company, say Apple or Google, you own equity. You have defined legal rights to a portion of the company's assets, and theoretically, a claim on future profits and earnings.
It's ownership.
It represents ownership defined by securities law. Simple as that.
But most of the time, especially in decentralized finance, the token you hold is primarily a utility asset. It exists to serve a function within that specific decentralized application or network.
Right. Its value proposition isn't necessarily derived from ownership or a claim on cash flows, but from its functional necessity. You might need that token to pay network fees, the gas required to transact or use the service. You might need it to collateralize loans, or very commonly, it enables participation in governance, allowing you to vote on the future direction of the project. It's an access pass, not a deed to the property.
And because tokens typically lack that direct legal ownership representation, that guaranteed claim on the business, their perceived value becomes incredibly sensitive to market mechanics.
Oh, incredibly.
It's far more susceptible to even small changes in circulating supply and demand than it is to the protocol's actual real-world business performance, at least in the short run.
Think about that difference. A stock price tends to track a company's earnings over decades. A token price, especially a governance or utility token, can move wildly based purely on how many people are holding it versus how many the protocol just took off the market.
Yeah.
If you change the availability, you change the perceived value almost instantly, regardless of the core product's health.
It's the sheer volatility and sensitivity that makes buybacks such an effective short-term lever. They generate three highly visible and immediate benefits for holders looking for quick returns, which we can detail as the three pillars of buyback power.
Right, so the first pillar is immediate demand. This is a guaranteed injection of liquidity. The protocol, using its own revenue or treasury funds, enters the open market and acts as a massive, reliable buyer of its own token.
So it's not waiting for new users to show up.
Exactly. It's not organic. This injection is crucial, particularly in down or sideways markets, where organic external demand, new users coming in and buying the token to use the service, is weak or entirely absent.
And this isn't passive. The protocol doesn't just wait, it actively sets a floor for demand. It tells the market there is guaranteed purchasing power here, regardless of market sentiment.
Yeah.
This stability can be invaluable for attracting or retaining liquidity providers who might otherwise flee.
And that leads right into the second pillar, which leverages that purchase to optimize the supply side, supply reduction.
Okay.
When tokens are bought on the open market using protocol revenue, they are typically permanently removed from circulation, a process referred to as burning.
We must be precise about the supply definition here. When we talk about circulating supply, we mean the tokens currently available and tradable on exchanges.
That's right. The stuff people can actually buy and sell today.
So when a protocol buys and burns them, that circulating supply instantly drops. This tightens the market float dramatically and accelerates scarcity narratives.
Fewer tokens are available for the same external demand, leading quickly to visible price pressure.
Oh.
Now, a critical nuance. Sometimes protocols don't burn the tokens. They move them into a treasury vault or governance pool.
Ah, okay.
And while this removes them from active circulation, they are still technically part of the total supply and could be reintroduced later. But for the purpose of market optics, simply tightening the float, whether through a burn or a lockup, is perceived as equally positive in the short term, fueling those scarcity expectations.
That leads directly into the third pillar, which is often the most potent, price reflexivity.
Yes.
This is a powerful self-reinforcing feedback loop. The buyback tightens supply and creates that immediate demand, causing the price to rise. That rising price then acts as free organic marketing, attracting attention.
It creates momentum. Algorithmic traders spot the uptick. Retail investors see the green candles and rush in, driven by FOMO or the fear of missing out. That attention attracts more liquidity, more capital flows into the project, and that fresh liquidity reinforces the price increase, generating real self-sustained momentum. It's a rapid generator of positive sentiment built on a mechanical action.
It's essentially a method of manufacturing momentum that entirely bypasses the slow, challenging, and often unpredictable work of actually growing a user base or building a truly sustainable product.
It's mechanical support versus organic adoption. And that's the temptation. But wait, how do you reconcile this scarcity narrative, the shrinking supply, with the reality that many protocols, especially those funding development or adoption through token grants, still have significant emissions?
Oh, that's a great point.
Aren't they essentially funding a demand mechanism just to absorb the supply they are simultaneously releasing?
That's a fascinating skeptical challenge. It raises a great point about capital efficiency. If a protocol is paying developers or awarding grants using newly minted tokens,
yeah,
inflation, and then turning around and using revenue to buy those exact same tokens back, you are, in a sense, paying twice for the same token supply stabilization. You've introduced supply to fund growth, then used precious, hard-earned revenue to undo that supply just for the sake of the price chart.
It suggests that the buyback is less about genuine scarcity and more about managing market expectations to offset the necessary token emissions required for ecosystem growth. It's almost a shell game if the net circulating supply isn't actually dropping significantly over time.
To make that whole mechanical concept concrete, let's use the example mentioned in the source material, which is based on a concept like the perpetual exchange Hyperliquid and its token. Let's call it HYPE.
Good idea. So imagine a user trading on Hyperliquid, generating a few dollars in fees every time they execute a trade. That fee revenue is the protocol's cash flow.
Okay.
The natural long-term path to token value creation depends on real user growth. If Hyperliquid gets 100,000 new active traders, the demand for HYPE needed perhaps for governance, staking, or paying fees grows gradually and organically.
But again, user growth requires excellent product execution, relentless marketing, team scaling. It takes time, perhaps years.
That's the slow, hard product work.
Yeah.
Now look at the buyback shortcut. The protocol takes that earned fee revenue, that precious cash flow, and instead of putting it all back into R&D or expansion, it uses it to buy its own token, HYPE, on the open market right now.
So an immediate effect.
The result is instant mechanical pressure. Demand rises immediately because the protocol is a guaranteed buyer. Circulating supply tightens instantly. The price often reacts fast and visibly. It's an immediate, high-certainty outcome.
Now, if Hyperliquid chose not to use buybacks, that organic user demand, the demand from people using the product, would only impact the price gradually.
Right.
It needs a massive, sustained surge in adoption to move the price significantly because the available supply of HYPE tokens remains constant.
That is the core of Segment 1, Buybacks are loved because they are visible, they are measurable, and they immediately signal the value is flowing directly back to the holders' pockets, providing instant gratification and price validation.
Okay, so we see the immediate mechanical benefits. They create instant demand, manufacture scarcity, and fuel reflexivity. But if the goal is to build a thriving, long-lasting ecosystem that solves real problems, how quickly does this demand injection actually change the long-term utility or usability of the token?
Doesn't. Utility requires user adoption and feature development.
Right. So now we have to talk about that trade-off.
Moving into segment two, we must now focus on the choice protocols face. Buybacks are not inevitable. They are a choice in capital allocation, and they come with an immense non-monetary price tag, the opportunity cost.
Mm-hmm.
Protocols generate cash or revenue from fees. They have far better options for what to do with that capital to drive sustainable growth.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because these alternative options focus on aggressively expanding the demand side of the equation rather than just contracting the supply side.
Exactly.
They focus on making the pie bigger, not just slicing it thinner.
Absolutely. The primary alternative, and the one that requires the most courage, is investment in product and features. This means directing capital towards creating fresh use cases, whether that's a new type of zero-knowledge proof, implementing a high-throughput Layer 2 scaling solution, or simply building a radically better user interface.
So, solving real problems for real users.
That's it. The payoff of true R&D is twofold. It attracts new external users who need that specific solution, and it earns durable, long-term revenue streams because the utility is inherent, not manufactured.
This is the absolute foundation of organic, sustainable growth, but it requires patience.
A lot of patience.
Yeah.
Another powerful strategy is business development, BD, marketing, and grants. This is the aggressive, proactive expansion of distribution.
So getting the word out.
Getting the word out and getting the product in. It means dedicating capital to forging strategic partnerships, maybe subsidizing integration costs for a major wallet or exchange, and pulling in massive new external demand that otherwise wouldn't find the product. This requires hustle, negotiation, and significant operational investment in human capital.
And the third major lever, often overlooked, is acquisitions.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Instead of spending 5 years building a competing product from scratch, a protocol can use its reserves to absorb existing, smaller, successful products, teams, and proven technology.
The benefit is immediate acceleration. You instantly gain active user bases, proven technology stacks, and human talent, expanding your footprint without the multi-year internal development cycle.
The crucial tension lies in the risk profile of these choices. These long-term growth paths, new products, distribution, acquisitions, are significantly slower to yield results. They are intrinsically riskier, and they are much harder to execute effectively.
They really are. Innovation is expensive, and failure is common. There is absolutely no guaranteed payoff.
A protocol might spend millions auditing a new smart contract architecture, only to discover a fundamental flaw that makes the entire approach unusable. Or they might spend a year on a marketing campaign that generates minimal ROI. That is the nature of growth.
Buybacks, by sharp contrast, work immediately. They're a relatively safe bet. They support the price with a high degree of certainty, providing instant gratification to current token holders.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the analysis concludes that buybacks are fundamentally a short-term lever. They manage supply scarcity, but they rarely generate lasting transformative value.
The focus shifts dramatically. When choosing a buyback, the team is choosing to solve a token price problem rather than solving a user problem.
Exactly. And we can ground this crypto concept in traditional finance using the very clear analogy of Apple, which, as we noted, is famous for its massive buyback programs. Let's consider Apple's staggering cash reserves.
If Apple uses a significant chunk of that cash for stock buybacks, what happens? They create immediate, relatively low-risk demand for the stock. Shareholders see a clear return on capital, and the stock price benefits from reduced supply.
It's a safe, immediate win.
And in Apple's case, it makes strategic sense because they are already so massive. It's hard for them to find another project that will double their size.
Now consider the alternative. If a younger company, let's say a mid-sized tech firm, uses that exact same cash to build a breakthrough product, we can think of the original iPhone development 2 decades ago. The payoff takes years, and it carries massive uncertainty.
Right. They could have failed.
The company could fail before the product ever launches. But the core insight is this. The upside from that breakthrough product is far more durable and exponentially larger.
The iPhone didn't just bump Apple's stock price. It fundamentally changed the entire enterprise value, creating entirely new multi-billion dollar business segments that dominated global markets for a decade.
It's the difference between optimizing existing assets and creating new ones.
And this comparison helps clarify the core dilemma protocols face, especially decentralized autonomous organizations, or DAOs. Buybacks optimize the circulating supply. You're making the existing pie look smaller and therefore more valuable per slice.
While product development, business development, and acquisitions, however, expand the demand side of the equation, they are focused entirely on making the pie itself exponentially bigger through new utility.
But let's look at the operational difference. When Apple decides on a buyback, it's a centralized decision made by an executive board and ratified by institutional shareholders who understand the long-term context of a mature business.
A DAO is different. Capital allocation decisions are often driven by token holder votes, and many token holders have extremely short time horizons.
Yeah.
They see the immediate mechanical benefit of a buyback and vote for that, putting immense and immediate pressure on the development team.
That pressure is real. Sometimes, when you're deep into the weeds of a project's success, spending months working on code optimization or a complex white paper, you start checking the token price multiple times a day, even though you know intellectually that the real, lasting value is happening in the smart contract code or the user interface.
Mm-hmm.
I still wrestle with that short-term gravity myself. It's incredibly hard not to look for those quick fixes when the entire community is focused on the price chart.
That's a very human admission, and it explains why the buyback lever is so tempting for teams operating under that kind of constant, decentralized, and often short-sighted community pressure.
It really is.
But it makes you wonder what the entire decentralized industry could achieve if all that revenue currently spent on buybacks was poured into high-risk, potentially world-changing research and development instead.
Whoa. Imagine scaling a decentralized application to a billion daily queries based purely on utility, not scarcity mechanisms or price pumping. Imagine if every protocol allocated 20% of its revenue to funding formal verification audits to prevent $100 million exploits. That's the real potential here that we are often sidestepping.
The opportunity cost is staggering. It's the investment that wasn't made in innovation, the groundbreaking zero-knowledge feature that ever got funded, or the security audit that never happened because the cash went towards stabilizing the price chart for 3 months.
If protocols consistently choose buybacks over long-term investment in R&D and distribution, what's the biggest risk to the broader crypto ecosystem's ability to compete with traditional centralized tech?
The risk is cannibalizing future innovation for temporary price stability, leading to market stagnation.
Moving to our final analysis point, we have to acknowledge the current reality of the crypto market. The source material suggests, and I think we agree, that the industry has likely leaned too heavily into buybacks recently as a reflexive default mechanism rather than a disciplined strategic choice.
Undeniably, we see many protocols that are clearly still in their high growth phase. They might only have 5,000 active daily users, or they have only launched their V1 product, yet they're directing significant excess capital toward buybacks instead of future development.
They would almost certainly benefit far more from directing that excess cash toward genuine acquisitions, expanding distribution into Asia or South America, or hiring 5 new core developers for building new product lines.
Yeah.
Instead, they chase that short-term price support because it's easier to implement and guarantees faster community satisfaction.
But this brings it to the core strategic nuance. The debate shouldn't be whether buybacks are inherently good or bad. That's a moral judgment, not a financial one.
Right.
The central issue is the timing and the intent behind the action.
Right. When is a buyback a sign of financial discipline? And when is it a sign of intellectual laziness or a lack of imagination?
The argument, which is strongly derived from best practices in traditional markets, is that token buybacks should be the final lever a team pulls, not the first or the only one.
The last resort, in a way.
Exactly. They should be a tool reserved for protocols that fit a very specific, high bar set of criteria. You can't use this tool in the early high-risk growth phase. You use it in the maturity phase.
Let's define those criteria in detail because they are essential for the learner to understand how to evaluate a buyback announcement.
Okay, the first necessary criterion is maturity and market dominance. The protocol must already be established and deeply entrenched within its market segment.
So not a brand new project.
Definitely not. We're talking about achieving a critical mass of users, hitting undeniable product market fit, and demonstrating resilience through multiple market cycles. It's not guessing. It knows its place, its niche, and its user base is stable.
And what will be the metrics for that?
Metrics here would include total value locked, TVL stability, sustained transaction volume, and a consistently high number of daily active users over several years.
Secondly, and this is non-negotiable, it must be robustly cash generative. The protocol needs robust, proven revenue streams that are resilient and sustainable. Crucially, this revenue must be consistently generated from real-world usage fees, transactions, services, not just from venture capital funding, native token inflation, or temporary yield farming incentives.
And we have to look closely at what the protocol is generating revenue in. Is it generating revenue in stablecoins, real cash flow, or in its own native token?
That's a great point.
If the revenue is largely in its own native token, the buyback is less a cash deployment strategy and more a circular reoptimization of token supply, which is far less impressive from a financial discipline standpoint.
You can't buy back tokens sustainably if you don't have the reliable external revenue to support it.
Exactly. And perhaps the most critical criterion and the hardest to prove is the third. The team must be genuinely exhausted of high return growth opportunities.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
This means the core team, after rigorous due diligence, has concluded that they have genuinely run out of high ROI opportunities for reinvestment in R&D, distribution, or user subsidies. They have maximized reasonable growth with their current model.
So any further spending on growth would have diminishing returns.
Precisely. Any further deployment of capital for internal innovation or expansion yields diminishing returns. In a traditional company, this is when they say, we can't feasibly double the size of the business through internal growth anymore.
And in crypto?
In crypto, this means we have built every necessary scaling solution, we have conducted every security audit, and we have penetrated every major geographical market.
This philosophy is exactly what underpins traditional market usage, and it needs to be the standard in crypto. In the conventional financial world, stock buybacks are heavily relied upon primarily by companies that are already too large to sustain exponential growth rates.
They're giants.
They are giants that choose to return value to shareholders because there are few internal avenues left for massive high-risk growth that could double the size of the company overnight.
The core distinction here is intent, and it's the difference between discipline and deflection. Is the buyback being used as a thoughtful, disciplined capital allocation strategy, meaning we have solved all our core growth problems and now this is the most efficient use of capital?
Or, and this is the danger, is it merely a shortcut deployed to avoid the harder essential work of continuing to build, distributing to new markets, and iterating on the core product?
Two-sec silence.
Yeah.
That silence truly encapsulates the strategic weight of that question.
Mm.
If you're a young protocol with millions of dollars in reserve and you're choosing buybacks instead of hiring three new senior developers specializing in zero-knowledge technology or executing a critical, expensive global marketing campaign,
yeah,
you're admitting one of two things. Either you lack the vision to reinvest that capital effectively, or you lack the ability to resist community pressure.
And that admission, even if unspoken, is what frustrates observers who believe in the power of decentralized innovation. We want protocols to spend money on solving problems for humanity, scaling, security, and accessibility, not primarily solving the problem of their token price chart.
Wait, let me challenge that premise slightly. While I agree that buybacks are generally overused, we must acknowledge a counterargument. Sometimes, token price stability is itself a critical security feature for a protocol.
How so?
Well, many governance systems rely on token holding. If the token price drops too low, it becomes economically feasible for a malicious actor to acquire enough tokens cheaply to achieve a 51% voting majority and drain the protocol's treasury or change its fundamental rules.
Okay, so a governance attack.
Exactly. A buyback, in this specific context, could be viewed not as a price pump, but as an essential defensive measure to secure the protocol's governance structure.
That shifts the perspective entirely. You're arguing that if the low token price presents a quantifiable economic or security risk, the buyback is actually a necessary R&D investment in the protocol's structural integrity.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fascinating exception.
Exactly. It moves the intent from make holders happy to prevent hostile takeover. We still judge the timing, but the motivation is defensive strategy, not mere price optimization.
So we established that strategic use supports maturity and is a sign of financial health. But we must now add that defensive use can be a sign of critical security need.
Right.
Shortcut use, however, overwhelmingly signals a lack of viable long-term growth plans.
If buybacks are supposed to be the final lever or a necessary security lever, what key metric or ecosystem status truly defines a protocol as mature enough to pull it for optimization purposes?
Operational scale and the quantified diminishing returns on internal R&D investment.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's try to wrap this up.
Okay.
Let's quickly synthesize the main takeaways for you, the learner. We've established that buybacks offer powerful instant benefits, immediate demand, manufactured scarcity, and rapid price reflexivity. But they mask a highly significant opportunity cost, which is the foregone investment in innovation. That critical choice boils down to a fundamental existential trade-off. Low risk, immediate price support versus high risk, potentially durable and transformative innovation.
Mm.
One optimizes the existing supply, the other expands genuine external demand.
Our conclusion, based on the material we analyzed, is that the best use of a buyback strategy is as a late-stage tool for capital return. For protocols that have exhausted high-growth reinvestment options and are simply seeking to return value efficiently. We also acknowledge the rare but valid defensive use case.
Crucially, it should never, under any circumstances, be a substitute for the difficult, essential work of building market share, developing a product users genuinely need, and allocating capital toward high upside growth initiatives.
When you look at any major protocol buyback announcement, you must ask yourself, does this look like a company that has solved all its growth problems, or does this look like a team trying to solve a short-term crisis of confidence?
This leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to consider as you assess these crypto projects and protocols. If token holders consistently and aggressively demand buybacks, forcing protocols to choose those short-term price bumps, beat, are we inadvertently punishing the teams willing to take the biggest, most necessary risks on innovative, long-term growth?
If the only projects that get rewarded by the market are the ones that prioritize manufactured price scarcity over product utility, what kind of behavior are we, the users, ultimately incentivizing across the entire decentralized landscape?
Yeah.
Think about the culture of innovation we are cultivating or stifling.
Thank you so much for sharing the source material that led to this incredibly deep dive. It provided excellent context for understanding the capital allocation debate in the crypto space.
We encourage you to continue exploring capital allocation strategies, looking not just at the balance sheet numbers, but at the intent behind the deployment of revenue, both in the decentralized finance world and in traditional finance.
Mm-hmm. Understanding that trade-off short-term certainty versus long-term opportunity is essential for any investor or builder.
We'll catch you next time for the next deep dive.